from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mornings, playing golf. Afternoons, smelling the roses, or at least a whiff of ease and security. For millions of Americans, the reality of retirement may fall far short of those long-held dreams. Defined pension benefit plans are disappearing. Many of those still afloat are struggling. Last week, the U.S. Postal Service said it may raise the price of a first-class stamp to 41 cents to cover the cost of financing its own pension program. And those much ballyhooed 401ks, turns out one in four Americans don't even contribute to them. Add to that tough landscape, personal savings are now at 0.4%, a record low. Social Security is sharply underfunded. And President Bush is pushing hard for personal savings accounts, putting more of the onus on you to make sure your numbers add up when you retire. With their so-called golden years coming around the bend, baby boomers could find themselves cold and hungry, and retirement itself may be slipping away as an idea, as a possibility. Tonight on Point, America's retirement mess. Who's ready, who's not, and what to do about it? You can join the conversation. Do you honestly have any idea what your own retirement is going to look like? Do you know how the pieces add up? Do they add up? And what are we marching toward here? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Tom Lorisella. He covers mutual funds and investing for the Wall Street Journal and wrote recently about millions of Americans mismanaging their 401ks. Tom, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
So here it is, your headline, a lesson for Social Security, many mismanage their 401ks. What kind of problems are you seeing in the way Americans deal with the money that they're managing to put aside?
Well, essentially what we wanted to do was take a look at how American workers have handled the responsibility of managing their own retirement money and investing their own retirement money since 401k plans were created about 23 years ago. As you were mentioning, previously most people, if they had retirement savings, it was coming from either Social Security or from pension plans run by the companies. But these days, more and more Americans are having to do it for themselves for 401k. And when you look at the statistics, they're really not all that encouraging. Actually, they paint a picture of Americans making many basic fundamental mistakes when it comes to investing.
This seems more important than ever now, with private retirement accounts being held up as maybe part of the future for Social Security. What kind of mistakes are Americans making with the 401k funds that they've put aside, Tom?
Well, you have to sort of start with the basic sort of philosophy behind investing over the long term. You know, folks look at the long-term track records of stocks and bonds over decades, and those numbers show that if you're younger, you should have a lot more investing in stocks because they have higher returns, but those higher returns come with bigger risks of losing money. So as you get closer to retirement, you should have less and less in stocks and more in bonds, which are less volatile and have, a much more sort of and offer sort of a predictable stream of income.
That's pretty simple, straightforward kind of investing 101. Are investors of 401k money overall doing that?
Probably about, depending on which sort of age group you look at and the way you slice the numbers, you can easily see that, perhaps half the people aren't getting it right in their 20s. I mean, you find some statistics show that folks in their 20s, more than half of the people who have 401ks who are in their 20s have very little, have less than half their money in stocks. I mean, that's way off. So right off the bat, most of the people who are in their 20s are doing it wrong. And these are people who've been working with 401ks since they got into the job market.
How significant can the consequences be if it's just not being done right, Tom?
Well, there's sort of different ways to look at it. Some folks say, well, if you're going to have something, as long as you don't completely blow it at the end of retirement.
Yeah, I'm sucking it away every week or every month. But don't still be too rough on me.
It's still money. It's still there. And, over a period of sort of 30, 40 years, you're still going to, you're still going to come out okay. And so chances are there will be something there. The problem is that what people need to think about just isn't that there is some money there, But will it be enough money for them to live on for 20 or so years after they retire? And so what you see is that, yeah, there's some money there, but it's not even close to enough.
What conclusions are you drawing here, Tom? And this is all going to get decided at a higher pay grade than either of us, I know. But what conclusions are you drawing about the move to put Social Security money into private retirement accounts? If Americans aren't managing their 401ks any better, does it make sense to move Social Security money into private hands?
Well, you know, we with this story, we tried not to get too much into the actual debate of whether or not it's a good idea.
I read that. I'm trying to pull you in now.
But, you know, what we wanted to show were the challenges, you know, and to show the irony of the fact that at the very same time that the government is very seriously considering giving Americans responsibility for managing their Social Security money, that's happening at the very same time that out in the private world, the companies that folks like to point to as being sort of the real efficient world as opposed to the government, is going the opposite direction. Companies are finding ways for workers to give up the responsibility for managing their money. So if you look at what's happening out in the real world at ground level, workers are saying, you know what, I don't have time for this. I have a lot of things going on in my life. I don't understand this. Please, you know, somebody else do this for me.
You mean, Tom, that employers are what, providing guidance or investment counsel to their employees about their 401k funds?
We have to sort of take a step back and look at how 401ks have evolved. For many, many years, for most of their history, the government did not want advice being given to workers in their 401k plans. They were worried about unscrupulous brokers or insurance salesmen or just unscrupulous anybody directing people to invest their retirement money in a way that would, you know, benefit the broker. And it's only in the last couple of years that the government has agreed to allow, you know, money managers like, say, Vanguard Funds, hire an independent company to provide advice. And so what we're seeing now is that companies are, employers are hiring these sort of independent third parties to give unbiased advice.
So instead of my 401k money just coming into my hands and I decide what to do with it, there's an intermediary who gives me guidance, or do I just sign over the investment to a third party?
You can just sign it over. You can say, you know, do what you want with this. You know, the idea is that they take a little bit of your personal history. They know how old you are.
Right.
They know how much money you make. Perhaps you tell them if you have other money, your spouse has some other investments, and then they sort of crunch all that stuff through a computer, and then they sort of take what's in your 401k plan, and they will do the managing for you. You literally never have to think about it again.
And you write, Tom, that a number of big companies are doing this now. What kind of response have they seen from their employees? Is this popular with 401k savers?
Yeah, this is just being rolled out, really, just in the last couple of years. As I said, it's only very recently that the government's allowing people to do this. And the early signs are that it's pretty popular. You know, and you have to sort of compare it to responses to other things. When the internet came around and people thought that they could educate workers over the internet about stocks and bonds and investing, they tried, but it turned out only, you know, single-digit percentages, 5-6% of people would actually take that advice and act on it. Now what we're seeing in many companies is at least a quarter of the workers volunteering from day one to just turn their money over to these outside professionals. And in the world of 401ks, which move very slowly, that's a big move very quickly. It's a very conservative place.
And a kind of acknowledgement among many 401k holders that they either don't know how to or don't want the responsibility of investing the funds that are going to make such a difference in their quality of life when and if they do retire.
You talk to, you know, employer after employer, and they hear the same thing from their workers, which is, you know, tell me what to do. You know, somebody please tell me what to do. I don't want this responsibility. Or they just don't feel comfortable with it. And, you know, they're finding that all levels, from, you know, top executives to the bottom rungs of their companies, are finding this an attractive option. It's not for everybody, but it certainly solves the problem for people who really don't know what they're doing.
Tom Lauricella, thanks so much for giving us the picture there.
No problem.
Tom Lauricella covers mutual funds and investing for the Wall Street Journal. He joined us from New York. I am joined right now in the studio by Alicia Munnell. She's director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, co-author of the book Coming Up Short, The Challenge of 401k Plans. She was a member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors from 95 to 97. She was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy from 93 to 95. Alicia Munnell, it's wonderful to have you with us here again. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
So we have a million questions for you tonight. Things just seem to be popping off on so many fronts around retirement. But the big picture I want to ask you, as we head into maybe Social Security reform, as we hear all this news about defined pension benefits continuing to drop away, you've got people who are retiring right now based on a system that was set up decades ago who may be doing all right. But when you look ahead out to the horizon where people who are now working and saving and thinking of the future are imagining a retirement, is the picture getting better or worse? Are we turning a corner on this kind of mess around retirement, or are we still headed into to more troubled waters here?
I can answer that question. Worse.
It's getting
definitely
worse.
Why?
Yes. What's going on?
This is the golden age. People are retiring right now. They're retiring before the Social Security retirement age has gone up from 65 to 67. Most of these people still have the old-fashioned defined benefit plans that make a benefit for us every year long as you live.
From your company, they've already stashed it away and invested, and you
can
count
on
that pension.
To worry about it at all. So these people are doing pretty well. But you look ahead a few years, and what do you see? You see the demise of defined benefit plans.
You're not going to get a pension from the company
anymore.
You're
not going to. You're going to have a 401k. And as Tom was saying, people don't manage their 401k very well. We looked at some data on how much people just before retirement have in these 401k plans, and it's less than
$50,000. $50,000?
That's the typical amount, not $200,000 or $300,000.
Now, you're saying right now, but presumably the people retiring in another 5 or 10 years will have more because they've been given a heads up.
That's right. But we did a little comparison of how much they actually have compared to how much they'd have to be on track to get a significant pile, and they're way behind.
Behind. If somebody wants to retire, I don't know, what's the median income in the States now of a family, $40,000,
$50,000? About $45,000.
So if you wanted to retire with just the median income in the United States, nothing lavish, but that $45,000, what kind of 401k savings would you need, or overall savings would you need?
Well, I mean, the way we look at it, the guy we looked at was a $50,000 guy, and basically you think you need about 80% of that to live in retirement because you paid off your mortgage.
If you had income of $50,000, now you want to retire, no mortgage, so you could live on, a 42 or something?
Yeah.
40.
And then you get today from Social Security kind of half of that.
Okay.
And what you'd like is for your 401k to make up the other half, because people have no savings other than their 401k.
Right, right.
They have their house and their 401k and Social Security, and that's it.
So what kind of pile does he need in that 401k?
Oh, it'd be nice not to have 40 or 50. It'd be nice to have 200,000.
So if you've got Social Security plus 200,000 in your 401k, in what year are we talking?
Today,
right now.
Just as you approach retirement. It'd be nice to have $200,000, $250,000.
Right.
Then you'd be the $50,000 guy could maintain his pre-retirement standard of living.
Okay, at that rather modest standard of living. And, of course, many people are going to be hoping to retire with quite a different standard of living than that.
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, it's not – I don't think people think in terms of upping their standard of living when they
retire. No, but they may start at a higher place. Of course, many do, but many don't. But many do.
Actually a really important point, you know, because with inflation, whatever you start with is worth much less 20 years down the road. And I think we're not so much worried about people in their 60s, but what are people going to look like in their 80s?
And are they better on track to keep up with that?
No, I think you see these 401k problems throughout the age distribution.
Right across. And what about the generation coming up behind? Are they doing a better job, people who are in their 40s and their 30s?
Well, there's this terrible temptation when you move from one job to another to cash out.
Because you have the opportunity.
Because you get the money. And, you know, why? Maybe it's time to buy a car. Maybe time to go on a trip. Maybe time to do something else. And the whole theory behind these 401ks is you put that money in, you keep it in, and a miracle of compound interest gives you a big pile of
retirement. And if that doesn't work, then maybe retirement doesn't work. Alicia Munnell, please stand by. We've got a lot more we want to ask you here tonight. We're talking about America's retirement mess, who's ready, who's not, and what to do about it. Alicia Munnell is with us. She's author of Coming Up Short, The Challenge of 401k Plans. You can join us as well. Do you honestly have any idea what your own retirement is really going to look like? Do you know how the pieces add up? do they add up? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's retirement mess, pensions disappearing, 401ks not adding up, Social Security on the block, at least in part. Nobody knows exactly how it's going to be financed as we move ahead. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Is a full pension getting to be an antique idea now? Do you welcome the opportunity to take more control of your own retirement finances, or are your retirement finances a black box, a mystery to you? Are we heading for a generation of threadbare seniors? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Alicia Munell, former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy, member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, co-author of Coming Up Short. Glenn's calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Glenn. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling because I used to work at a major teaching hospital in downtown Boston.
Yeah.
And the 401k program was a typical one where you had to opt in. It wasn't automatic. You had to actively do something.
I think they're all still that way. We'll have Alicia tell us. But yeah, okay.
Right.
And was everybody doing it?
No. There were people at the lower end of the economic scale who didn't understand it, didn't trust it, and would not do it. I begged my coworkers to do it, and they wouldn't do it.
And essentially, apart from Social Security, that may be all they're going to have when they retire.
Could be. I don't know all their personal details. This is, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, but it was like you couldn't talk them into doing it,
right.
even with matching.
Right. Even with everything that's out there. Glenn, thanks for calling. Alicia Munell, here's the issue. First of all, is it always an option? Are some people automatically enrolled in 401ks these days?
The Treasury issued new rules in 1998 that allowed companies to automatically enroll people. Because as somebody mentioned at the top of the hour, either you or the other, Tom, 25% of the people who could participate in 401k plans don't.
Do not. Mm-hmm.
And as Glenn said, they're mostly lower income people. So with this automatic enrollment experiment, what people found is that the enrollment rates increased enormously. People are racked by inertia and tend to stay where they're placed.
Mm-hmm.
And so you place them in, they tend to stay in. Mm-hmm. 2 or 3 years down the road,
it automatically comes out, but they're in.
They automatically comes out and they're in. If they have to choose, then you just don't see that kind of participation.
And what about what people are facing at the end of this arc that we're describing here? What's it going to look like? If you look out, 10 or 15 years, you pick the time frame. But do we have, seniors in pup tents somewhere in New Mexico squatting? I don't know. How does it all play out?
Well, I mean, in real life, people don't fall off a cliff. But they could have to rejuggle their affairs at a time when they're sort of older and more vulnerable.
Rejuggling affairs sounds almost fun. What do you mean by
no,
that?
No, it's not fun. It's sort of picking up some work to make sure they can get by. I mean, I think when you look out, what your point was, things are getting worse. You're not going to have as much from your employer-provided pension.
Mm-hmm.
Social Security is not going to give you as much. People are not saving on their own, even though they see these other trends.
Mm-hmm.
People have a house, and that's all they have. And so my view is that going forward, people are just not going to be able to retire at age 62, which is the typical retirement age now.
So that whole notion of the retirement, is it going to go away? Is it just going to be later in life if you're lucky enough to get there?
Well, I think that I think a lot of institutions are going to have to change. Individuals are going to have to become more flexible. Employers are going to have to value older workers more. And I think that all may happen because we're going to see much slower growth in the labor force under age 50. So older workers may become more attractive. But if people plan and the changes can be undertaken, it doesn't seem like such a dismal future. The retirement income is not going to be there, but the job opportunities may well be there. And as you said, 62 is pretty young these days, and to retire at 62 and play golf for 20 years doesn't sound like such a great deal for many people.
Maybe not. On the other hand, a lot of people don't think of retirement as something that involves work. They think of it as just the opposite.
They're going to have retirement maybe just shorter.
Or a shorter day. Alicia Munell, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Columbia, Maryland, Michael Kitsis. He is Director of Financial Planning at the Pinnacle Advisory Group. It's a private wealth management firm that oversees more than $340 million in client assets, a financial planner. Michael Kitsis, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. We asked you on because we hope that you'll take us through a few scenarios here that will help us, help our listeners, think through their own personal circumstances. But let me ask you first, Michael, when people, I don't know if you deal with people right across the spectrum or you're talking about private wealth, if you're talking about wealthy individuals, but when people invite you in to look at their retirement plans, they've got a pile of files on the kitchen table, how does it typically look when you first look under the covers?
It varies tremendously. It really does. We see, you know, one group of people that are really the diligent savers. A lot of them are sort of the millionaire next door type. They've lived reasonably modest lifestyles and reasonably modest homes, driving modest cars,
and through and that managed to accumulate.
And yes, and they didn't do anything magical or special. They were just they accumulated. They spent less than they earned over their lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And it accumulates over time, often to very sizable sums.
So there's the happy scenario, and good on them. But that can't be everybody looking at these figures.
Unfortunately, not. You know, the flip side that we see of that are you know sort of two scenarios. You know, one are the folks that sort of come to the table and just haven't really started doing anything yet. Perhaps they might even have very high incomes, but they've been spending all of that income,
yeah.
And there's just no savings there. Or the alternative we occasionally see is there's a very substantial house that is a nice place to live but doesn't provide any food on the table
mm-hmm.
when they retire,
mm-hmm.
and that's the only assets that are there. The other side that we see, which is sometimes you know even more painful, are the folks that have done a pretty good job saving, and they've saved a pot of money, and we might see $250,000. Sometimes we might see $500,000, and they've got this vision of you know retiring together off to you know where their kids live and living on $100,000 a year,
mm-hmm.
and they figure they'll get a little from Social Security, and they'll just take $50,000 or $60,000 a year from the portfolio,
and they'll have a nice Cadillac and tool around the country,
right.
and take the kids out to dinner and nice Christmas
and,
presents.
And you know they've got this image. Well, you know we read that the markets average 10 to 12% over the long term.
Yeah.
So if I've got $500,000, I could spend $50,000 a year and
mm-hmm.
never have to worry.
Mm-hmm.
And you know it's unfortunately those folks that are perhaps the most difficult to sit down with and you know have to sort of painfully educate that unfortunately when you're talking about a 25, 30, 35 year retirement, even sums like $500,000 don't really go as far as people think it does anymore.
Well, Michael, I wish you'd take us through a few scenarios there because I'm sure people are listening and trying to place themselves in a spectrum of future lives of retirements. If we could play a little game here, I'd love to just imagine, let's say, a couple, 50, 55 years old. And I wish you could walk us through, let's say if they've got $50,000 household income now, if they've got $100,000, if they've got $200,000, and their retirement expectations are kind of shaped by their current income, what kind of saving, what kind of nest egg are you recommending when they reach retirement? Give us some scenarios.
Well, we'll kind of start with sort of the easier version that where we're going to say, let's assume all these folks are going to live on something roughly similar to what they're living on right now.
Okay, they'd like to. Okay, not stepping down, but just a straight line on, okay?
Sure. Now, it varies a little on the spectrum. The folks that we see, you know, with the income of around $50,000 a year, for those folks, Social Security is often going to be a major portion of their retirement.
Right, at least even though I was saying maybe half.
Could easily be. Particularly if with a married couple, either husband and wife were both working with Social Security, or the husband has a substantial earnings record and the wife is going to take the spousal benefit of half of his Social Security.
Right.
And we can see that getting to anywhere from $15,000 to $25,000 a year to get them on their way.
So they're 55 now. What do they need to be aiming for? You tell me when they retire. What do they need to be saving? What do they need to be aiming for as a total savings?
Well, the general rule of thumb that we like to use, and there's been a lot of research going on in the financial planning field these days about what we call a safe withdrawal rate.
Mm-hmm.
How much can you withdraw from a portfolio safely, and you know, essentially have it last no matter what the market does?
But I want to know what's got to be in the portfolio in the first place.
Well, so what we can do is we can work backwards, and that safe mm-hmm. withdrawal rate says that you can withdraw about 4% of your portfolio. And even if you retired in 1929 and you saw, you know, a decade of Great Depression before the market started helping you again,
right,
you still would have survived through that scenario and been able to continue your spending and adjust for inflation over time.
4%, so that's not that much of the pot. So the pot's got to be pretty good size.
Correct. So if we, you know, kind of work backwards here, if we have a 4% withdrawal rate, we're talking about capitalizing things at a 25 multiplier. So basically, imagine if you wanted to take $10,000 a year out of your portfolio, you need to multiply that by 25. You need $250,000 in there to do it.
Okay.
So now when we're talking about a couple that's looking to retire in $40,000 or $50,000 a year, Social Security is going to provide about half of that, and we're looking to take $20,000 to $25,000 a year out of our portfolio.
Yeah.
We're all of a sudden talking about $500,000 pot.
And that's to have a $40,000 or $50,000 income, and let's just look at $100,000 and $200,000 quickly.
Now as we jump up to $100,000 and $200,000, now we often see Social Security is playing less of a role here on a relative basis. Mm-hmm. Now we're looking at making up, let's say, on a $100,000 salary, $60,000 to $70,000 worth of income to be drawn off the portfolio.
Right.
So now, you know, again, using our 25 multiplier, now we're talking about something like $1.5 million to support a $100,000 a year lifestyle after Social Security takes a little bite out of that.
Okay, and for the really lucky couple up at that $200,000 retirement income?
And for that couple all the way up there at the $200,000 income range, now all of a sudden we're talking about something in the $4 million range.
$4 million in the bank. Alicia Minnell, does this line up with your kind of understanding of what it takes?
It's a little worse in the sense that,
worse meaning?
In that Michael hasn't considered the alternative of an annuity. And if you buy annuities, the $100,000 would give you sort of $100,000 would give you about $700.
7%.
It gives you a little bit more.
A little more than 4%
yeah.
In any case.
And that makes a difference. But annuities, you know, then you're giving away your money and people don't like them.
For people who have avoided learning about that, it means you put the money in there
and you can't take it out.
You give the insurance company
$100,000 mm-hmm. and they give you a monthly payment of $700.
And, you know, what we're really seeing is, you know, that annuities really do help us, you know, get there and bridge that gap, but it's a real dilemma for a lot of people of, you know, I can buy this annuity and, you know, I know what my check's going to be for the rest of my life and, I know it's going to be there and I don't have to worry about the income anymore, but the classic catch of the annuity is that lump sum, whatever's left over, is not going to go to the children, is not going to go to the heirs anymore.
Right, so it's gone. We've got a lot of callers wanting to get in here. I want to begin to invite them. Matthew's calling from New York City. Hi, Matthew. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to point out, in response to Stephanie's observation, that when people change jobs, they're often tempted to trade in their 401ks.
Very tempting. Alicia Minnell was saying many do.
It's not always to buy a car or take a trip.
Meaning?
Bear in mind, I had a friend and colleague who was working freelance and contracted appendicitis, and from that, peritonitis. He had to cash in and spend his entire 401k to pay his hospital bills.
On health care, on a single bout of bad health. That's rough going, Matthew. Did that wipe out his 401k, you're saying?
Yep.
Wow, that's a tough story. Thanks for calling in with it. I want to turn right now to Janet Bodner. She's executive editor of Kiplinger's, author of Think Single, the Women's Guide to Financial Security at Every State in Life. Janet Bodner, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Oh, my pleasure.
So you're at Kiplinger's. You try and give people lots of different kinds of advice about how to make it effectively through to retirement. I guess the people who subscribe to you are already focused on this. What's your sense of how your readers are doing, even with your advice?
Well, I think there's a lot of interest in the subject. We do a special retirement cover of the magazine each year, and it's one of our bestsellers. We also do a special retirement issue, and that's a really good seller. So there's a huge amount of interest in it. And a lot of the people who read our magazine are very focused on doing it themselves, you know, running their own investments, managing their own investments. So they really want to know what is available to them? What can they do to bridge the gaps that you've been talking about? How do they need to invest? What kinds of programs can they run on the computer?
And you must attract that kind of subscriber.
Right.
And you, of course, part of your marketing or your appeal is to say to them, you can do this
right.
if you pay attention to us. Do they succeed?
Well,
I guess you've got to say yes, don't you?
But what I was going to say is, though, that not everyone is as interested or is as focused. In fact, I've seen some studies lately showing that a lot of the people who are managing their own or who have 401k plans don't want to manage them plans by themselves, or at least they want some sort of input. So you have more companies, more investment companies offering to take over that task from people who don't want to do it themselves.
And we just heard tonight from the Wall Street Journal reporter who was writing that story last week. What's your sense, Janet, overall, as we move into what appears to be coming, which is a time when people have more responsibility for their own retirement? Are they going to be as well off as their parents have been in this sort of what Alicia Minnell calls a golden age of retirement, defined benefit plans, big investment houses would do the investing? You didn't worry about it.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, it's hard to tell. I mean, I suppose in some respects they won't be as well off in the sense that it was all taken care of for them and they didn't have to worry about it. But on the other hand, you know, we live in a whole different job market nowadays. People don't, by and large, stay with the same employer for their entire careers as they may have a generation ago.
Yeah.
So at least the upside of being able to manage your own retirement plan is that you can take it with you. You do have the option of taking it with you if you switch jobs, and so you don't have the golden handcuff, so to speak.
You don't just lose it again and again as you move. Janet Bodner at Kiplinger's, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Janet Bodner, executive editor of Kiplinger's. Alicia Minnell, you've been listening on now to the financial advisor, to the financial journalist here. What's your sense of what you're hearing?
I mean, my sense of what I'm hearing is that there have been a lot of studies of how well people are doing today. Mm-hmm. And basically, to oversimplify, these studies say one-third of the population is doing fine, of people who are entering retirement.
Okay.
One-third are doing okay if nothing goes wrong, and one-third are not doing very well at all. And the people who I worry about are in that. I worry about the bottom who are never going to do well. And
but
we should talk about them because
they don't have
any 401k to start with. So we don't have to we tend to ignore them in this problem.
And we won't do that. But the middle third,
what does
OK mean?
OK means that, you know, you had a DB plan or some defined benefit plan, but not that large. And you have some Social Security and you're doing all right. But I think that third in the future is extremely vulnerable.
Do they know that?
No, they don't. And it's very hard to get people's attention because you look out at people who are just entering retirement and they look great.
Mm-hmm.
They're having a wonderful time.
Mm-hmm. Because they haven't reached
the
time when
they've
eaten up too much of their seed corn.
Well, they haven't eaten up too much of the seed corn, and the big systems, the pension systems and the Social Security systems, are at their prime.
Oh, they're working right now. So people look around and say, well, why worry? Most people who are retired seem fine.
Yep.
I'll be fine, too.
Exactly.
But there's a big pothole waiting out there.
Well,
we're going to come back and look at exactly that. Michael Kitsis, Alicia Minnell, please stand by. We're talking tonight about America's retirement mess, and that is not too tough a word on it. Pensions disappearing, 401ks not adding up, Social Security on the block. You can join the conversation tonight. Is a full pension getting to be an antique idea now? Is America surrendering the very idea of a good retirement, whether it knows it or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's retirement mess, about who's ready, who's not, and what to do about it. I'm joined tonight by Alicia Minnell, co-author of the new book, Coming Up Short, The Challenge of 401k Plans. She's director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. And from Columbia, Maryland, by Michael Kitsis. He is a financial planner with the Pinnacle Advisory Group. You can join us, too. Are you saving what you should for retirement? Do you know what you should be saving? And what are we marching toward in American retirement? Are we better off with each person on their own or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Charles is calling from Holcomb, Wisconsin. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
And it's a very timely subject to write at the moment.
How so, Charles?
Well, let's put it this way. I was one of the lucky people. I did save religiously into my 401k, and it was nicely matched.
Good for you.
I was given in-house training by my employer on how to manage it properly.
So it sounds like easy street here, Charles.
Let me finish.
Okay.
Anyway, I was also warned that during the last 5 years, just prior to retirement that you should be very, very conservative, mm-hmm. which it was, put it in bonds.
Yep.
Wow.
And left when I was feeling very good in 2000.
Oh, 2000.
Of course, they required that I give it to a financial planner who during that first year lost 50% of it.
Oh, no.
Who required that you give your 401k to a financial planner?
I work for the federal government.
I see.
They require it.
So
they don't trust us.
So they took it out of your bond investment, put it in the stock market, and lost internet bust?
I thought the NASDAQ was real good at the time.
Oh, it couldn't have done worse in 2000. So what did that mean? Have you retired now, Charles?
Well, I'm technically retired that works 52 hours a week.
What are you doing in retirement, if I may ask?
I'm working for a sports-type shop.
Sports, like selling sports goods?
Yeah.
Sporting goods?
Yeah.
But you're not playing golf, I hear that, at 52 hours a week.
No, I'm not. I've got a lot of the toys, but I don't have time for them. And the biggest thing that really, really bothered me was the fact that I'm not alone out here with people that lost an awful lot of money mm-hmm. due to somebody else running their system. You know, I have to admit, had this individual been right, taking the chances, we wouldn't have been having this conversation if he had made me a whole bunch of money.
But that's just it. The risk came, and it bit you, and it bit you hard. Charles, thanks very much for that call. Alicia Minnell, how about this story? I mean, we've been saying tonight 401ks, many people are now looking to give them to investment companies to do some of the investing for them. But here was Charles. He gave his money to a financial planner. They hit you know what happened in 2000.
It sounds like a very bad financial planner because Charles was approaching retirement, and the idea of putting him all in sort of high-risk stocks doesn't sound like a very sensible thing at all. But Charles was not alone. I mean, if you look at the work activity of people 55 to 65, it took off after 2000 when the stock market collapsed because so many people with 401ks approaching retirement had so much in stocks.
Well, and Michael Kitsis, what about that the bell rang pretty hard and pretty dark in the year 2000. Did it scare people away from the stock market? Did it make them afraid to put their funds where they are going to need to put them to get the returns to retire?
It did. You know, we saw sort of two groups of folks. You know, one was the group that was unfortunately probably way too aggressive to begin with. They were highly exposed to some of the areas that were hit the hardest.
Yeah.
These would be people that would be coming to our doorstep saying, you know, I've just gone through these horrendous losses, you know, help me put things back together. Mm. And, you know, unfortunately, to a large extent, there's only so much you can do once things are down, aside from reassess goals and, you know, come up with a feasible game plan about what you can do going forward. Mm. But the other group that we would see, you know, perhaps the group that's it's even harder to deal with are the folks that are perhaps right on that cusp for retirement or they're really entering into retirement.
Right.
And the reality is they're still going to need to be in the stock market to some extent because they're looking at 30-plus year retirement periods or at least potentially 30-plus year retirement periods.
And if they don't want to eat through those savings, if they want to have something near the kind of income that they've looked forward to, they're going to need the return that only the stock market's currently giving.
Or at least some blend, you know, that to be, you know, to have no stocks, to be 0% in stocks can be very disastrous to portfolios over multi-decade periods. And it doesn't necessarily take a lot. By the time you get your portfolio about 30 or 40% into stocks, you substantially help that long-term portfolio sustainability. It makes a tremendous difference. So it's not necessarily about being all the way up at 80% or 100% all your portfolio in stocks.
Right. But even at 30 or 40%, suddenly you're retired and you've got risk.
Yes. and it's frightening, and it's only compounded even more by, you know, markets that are, you know, as severe both in their upswings and their downswings as we've seen over the past 5 years.
And you look at the dollar wobbling and all the question marks about the U.S. economy. It must make people have night sweats. Let's get another call here. Steve is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What a fascinating subject. And since you're just hitting on the tip of the iceberg, I'll just hit on a few things.
Please.
All right. First, Americans, I've been investing for 36 years.
Yes.
And Americans, they especially when it comes to savings, we're now at an all-time low, 2%, according to the Wall Street
Even lower, 0.4%. Yep.
Well, Wall Street Journal just reported 0.2%.
Oh, even lower. Okay.
Yep.
Watch out. Temperature's
right,
dropping.
And that's, you know, compared to a savings rate that was about 6% back in the 50s,
yes.
much higher rate.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a high debt load in this country. And a lot of that debt is in credit cards.
Right.
Americans that the average savings of, outside of a mortgage, the average amount of assets,
mm-hmm.
including an automobile, in America is $47,000.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a lot. And this is by the Employment Retirement Benefit Council, ERBI.
So where's it headed, Steve?
And let me tell you about some of the myths that we have. And first myth,
Steve, I want you to take us to the bottom line because our time is short. Where do you think this is all headed?
I think we're headed for, with 83 million baby boomers retiring over the next 20 years, I think we're headed for a socioeconomic crisis of millions of people going into poverty and living on Social Security, which is the maximum benefits, about $20,000 a year.
And that's not going to be fun. Steve, our time is short, but thank you for that call. Alicia Minnell, how about it? Are we going to see, I don't know, tent cities of retired people, living in teepees in the Florida panhandle? What are we going to do with people who just don't have an appropriate income stream when they really can't work anymore?
And the question is, what does that mean? When can you really not work anymore? And I guess you need to have lots of shows, Tom, so that you educate people that they're not going to have as much money as they think. And they make plans when they're 30, 40, 50, that they're not going to retire at 62. They're going to retire at 67 or 65. And that helps a lot.
But are we going to see millions and millions of Americans taking big, big downward steps in the standard of living to threadbare territory in their retirement?
I keep repeating, I think that the answer lays in staying in the workforce longer.
So in other words, don't retire. But we want to talk about retirement. People look forward to it. That's part of traditionally the payoff of working all your life.
But the thing is, do you realize how long people live now? You mm-hmm. retire at 62, you have a really good chance of living. The average, typical person will live 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You have a really good chance of living 30 years. What are you going to do with 30 years? Work is a favorable thing. Provides structure for your day, companionship.
Right. Keeps you out, up, and active and alert. Michael Kitsis, in your clients, do you see, even those who have the funds, we've just got a minute left here, do you see them saying, you know what, I think I will work a bit longer. I'm no longer gunning for that 55, 58, even 62, 65-year retirement.
We absolutely do, and we see it twofold. Not only the folks that, kind of come up to retirement and look forward and go, oh, my God, I don't know what I'm going to do for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we see even more so the folks that actually, they go into retire. They spent 3 months or 6 months or a year or 2 years, and they go, I'm bored. I need something to do. And they go back. They stay in the workforce. They go back in the workforce. And they usually change jobs. They find something that's more personally rewarding, something that's more interesting to them, something that they've always wanted to do.
So retirement, a kind of change of gears, not just going to the golf course, but something a bigger transformation.
Right. And it doesn't, it pays them okay. They make a little money. The fact of the matter is that even a little bit of income goes a long way, part-time work, whatever.
Michael Kitsis, with that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Michael Kitsis, Director of Financial Planning at the Pinnacle Advisor Group in Columbia, Maryland. Thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Alicia Minnell, co-author of Coming Up Short and director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Wonderful to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's always fun to be here.
You can continue this online in a moment. Reflections on the recent killings of deer hunters in Wisconsin. This is On Point. Last week, a Laotian Hmong immigrant was formally charged with 6 counts of murder after he opened lethal fire on a group of deer hunters November 21st. Details of what exactly happened in the northern Wisconsin woods remain something of a mystery. Chai Su Vang says he wandered onto private property and felt threatened when he was surrounded by a group of hunters who yelled racial taunts. Prosecutors argue the facts of the case differently. 23-year-old Hmong American Pa Lo was shocked when she heard about the Wisconsin deer hunting massacre. In this radio diary, she says the story reminds her of the difficulties her parents' generation of Hmong continue to face as they try to integrate themselves into their new American homeland.
As a child born in America to Hmong immigrants, the role of mediator between my elders and the things they discovered here fell heavily upon me. Lately, as I read of a Hmong man accused of shooting and killing Caucasian deer hunters in Wisconsin, I feel the bridges I have built over a lifetime to connect a past world to this one crumbling under national scrutiny. When I was a child, I would have to remind my grandmothers to pick up the telephone receiver before dialing. They would forget and first push numbers confidently, then wonder why they heard only a dial tone when they lifted the receiver to their ears. It was my generation who mustered the patience to teach these things one day at a time. When I learned that Chai Soa Vang, a Hmong refugee from Laos, had been arrested in connection with a Wisconsin shooting that left 6 dead and 2 wounded, my immediate reaction was to disassociate myself. One drop in the basket can taint the batch, Hmong say, because in the old country, rodents often crawled into wicker baskets and left droppings that, no matter how small, spread unwanted odors to soil entire batches of clean rice. I denounce unconditionally the acts of violence with which Mr. Vang stands accused, but in light of his alleged motives, I have come to claim a collective responsibility. If he wandered illegally onto private property and in fact was met with racial taunts, as he claims, then this tragedy is a metaphor for gaps in communication I still do not know how to bridge. With our reasons for being in America not always understood, being Hmong here meant that I was always wandering into private spaces, uninvited. It has been nearly 30 years since my parents came from Laos as refugees, and still they worked to find a valid place in America. My father was a soldier, recruited and trained by the CIA to fight inside Laos during the Vietnam War. His role was to guard part of the Ho Chi Minh Trail and to fight encroaching North Vietnamese forces. A grenade attack in 1968 left shrapnel in both his legs, his only real evidence of service in an undocumented war. 5 years later, Laos fell to communism, and many Hmong feared that their direct ties to America would make them targets for retaliation. Thousands evacuated, and some were eventually resettled to the United States. Assimilation in America has been difficult because the world from which Hmong come is drastically different, and the conditions that brought them here abrupt. When I was in middle school, I warned my father not to fish in certain places. He was angered and confused by rules of licensing and legal versus illegal catches. "You call this the land of freedom, but I am not free to fish where I please," he said. As a boy, my father had picked up a bamboo fishing rod and caught anything he pleased, from any river he wished. That defined for him what it meant to be truly free. Mediating between cultures meant more than simply conveying rules and regulations or translating a set of English words into Hmong. It meant explaining to Caucasian neighbors, some of whom were inclined to say, "Go back to your own country," that we had not come for economic gain, but as refugees from a war lost in partnership with America. Last year, 15,000 Hmong refugees were approved for resettlement to America. With more expected over the next year, they too will need a bridge between worlds. At first, I tried to separate myself from Mr. Vang, an attempt to avoid guilt by ethnic association. When his ethnicity grabbed the national spotlight, I feared that attempts made to understand the Hmong would, under the circumstances, unfairly taint my people. Today, I am more afraid that, if there is any truth behind a cultural clash as a partial explanation for this tragedy, the bridge my generation tried to build is not resilient enough. If that is true, if I have failed in my role as mediator, I hope to learn and do better, both for the new Hmong refugees and for my Caucasian neighbors.
Paolo writes for the Pacific News Service in San Francisco. She's working on her first book, a still untitled memoir. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.